Modern-day historians tell us our nation's founding fathers were a diverse group of atheists, deists, and political revolutionaries. So where did they find the common ground and inspiration for the ideas that birthed America? Did their faith play a role? Or do we have, as many claim, a godless constitution? Join historian David Barton with special guests Glenn Beck, Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, and more as they explore the America our founding fathers envisioned. What if America's story is bolder, more colorful, and more compelling than you ever imagined? This is Foundations of Freedom.
Welcome to Foundations of Freedom, where we'll look at important aspects of our common heritage that very few folks today hear anything about. Joining me today is Rick Green. Rick is an attorney, he's a former legislator, he's an author of numerous books, and he's also the head of Patriot Academy, which is a wonderful youth program that teaches young people how to be our future civil leaders. And Rick, you and I also co-host a daily radio program heard nationally, and it's an honor to have you with us.
It's my privilege to be with you. I'm looking forward to talking about Foundations of Freedom, because it seems like we're losing some of those freedoms, and people are hungry. They want to know, what are the foundations? How did we become so successful as a nation, and why are we losing it? But I think most of the time we think about foundational documents as the Constitution and Declaration. Our topic today, we're going to talk about the Bible, and maybe most people don't recognize that as a foundational document of America.
It is, and one of the interesting things that political scientists have found in looking back at our founding era, which runs from 1760 to 1805, they said, where did these guys get all these remarkable ideas? And when they looked to see what the founding fathers and others in that era quoted, the Bible was the number one source. Far and away, more than any other source, the Bible was the most frequently quoted source. So it is a founding document of America, no question.
Well, we've got some questions from our audience about the role of the Bible in our culture today, so let's go to some of those.
I often hear Christians quoting Bible verses when they're talking about history and culture. Why do they have to inject the Bible into everything?
Well, here we're talking about the Bible as a founding document, but some people don't want to hear it at all in the culture. Maybe they feel like you're preaching at them even when you just quote a Bible.
Well, that's one of the things that most folks today don't know. But to say, I don't want to hear the Bible injected, too late, already there. Just a good example. We have over 250 idioms that we use on a daily basis that are direct quotations out of the Bible. You hear this all the time. A great book on that. This book, professor's gone through and just documented what we say to each other that's the Bible. But I just took some of them out of it. By the skin of your teeth. That's out of Job. I'll give you my 2 cents worth. That's out of Mark.
I use that one all the time. People are using these.
Oh, they use them all the time. A leopard can't change his spots. There's nothing new under the sun. The Bible is so much a part of what we do, people don't recognize it. Now, what's happening is once we start identifying, they say, whoa, don't talk to me about the Bible. Too late. You already use the Bible so much yourself.
I was about to say, they're using it. The ones that are complaining about you,
that's
using
right.
it, they're actually quoting it. They don't even know.
They just don't have
it.
A clue. So to say that we shouldn't be injecting the Bible on things today, we wouldn't be America. We wouldn't even have our language. We wouldn't have our fine arts and entertainment. We wouldn't have what we enjoy today if the Bible hadn't been injected into it.
It's been there from the beginning. All right, let's grab another question.
Hi, I'm really involved with the youth activities at my church, and so I was wondering when you thought was the right time for youth to start reading and really studying the Bible.
That's a great question. I'm curious myself. I got 4 kids, so what is the right time to start training them or giving them the opportunity to study the Bible?
Well, you've got examples from both Bible and from American history. And when you look at American history, the right time to start training them is when they start learning to read. For example, when Washington, D.C. became the national capital. Now, we'd first been back in New York City for a year and then in Philadelphia for 10 years, and then in 1800, we moved into Washington, D.C. The president at that point in time is Thomas Jefferson. And President Thomas Jefferson is made a regent on the school board for Washington, D.C. public schools. They actually wanted him to be the president of the school board. He said, no, I'm doing a different president
right now.
I'm a little busy, but I'll help you. And so Thomas Jefferson's credited with outlining and forming the plan of education for Washington, D.C. public schools. And when you look at the very first report of Washington, D.C. public schools, it's interesting that they say students learn to read from 2 books. Now, this is one. This is a Bible from when Thomas Jefferson was president, and that's one thing they learned to read from. And the other is this right here. It's called Watts' Hymnal. let me read to you.
Hang on, I'm stuck on the fact that you said this is, they were learning to read from the, Bible. This is a public school.
Learning to read from the Bible. And Thomas Jefferson, who is credited as being the guy who, he wanted a secular society. He's the guy who came up with this plan of education. So let me just read you from the first report of Washington, D.C. Public Schools. Again, this is the school system where Jefferson's credited with creating the plan of education. Here's what it says. First report says, 55 have learned to read in the Old and New Testaments, and all are able to spell words of 3, 4, and 5 syllables. 26 are now learning to read Dr. Watts hymns and spell words of 2 syllables. 10 are learning words of 4 and 5 letters. Of 59 out of the whole number admitted that did not know a single letter, 20 can now read the Bible and spell words of 3, 4, and 5 syllables. 29 read Dr. Watts hymns and spell words of 2 syllables, and 10 words of 4 and 5 letters.
I'm amazed by two things. First of all, that they were reading the Bible, but also five syllable. I don't even know if I know any 5 syllable words. They're reading 5 syllables.
This is the beginning of spelling. This is where they're starting. Now, so when did they begin? You take, for example, Harriet Beecher Stowe, who did Uncle Tom's Cabin. When she was 7 years old, she'd already memorized 27 hymns, and she knew several chapters out of the Bible. Now, let's not stop with Harriet Beecher Stowe. Let's go to John Witherspoon, signer of the Declaration of Independence, president of Princeton. When he was 4 years old, he'd already read the King James Bible through from cover to cover. So, 4 years old, he's already read this cover to cover.
A 4-year-old reading at all is amazing.
Nobody told him he couldn't read it.
4-year-old reading cover to cover.
See, his parent, you can't read that. He doesn't know that. If you say, you can learn to read this.
But is it expectations then?
It's expectations. And we expected kids to learn. And so when he's 4 years old, and by the way, when he was still a child, he'd memorized nearly the entire New Testament, signer of the Declaration. You've got folks like John Trumbull. Now, he's one of our literary figures. He did these works right here. John Trumbull, on the Supreme Court of Connecticut, at the age of 6, he had already mastered Greek. He knew Greek better than this minister did.
At six years old,
you have George Wythe, who's a signer of the Declaration of Independence. When he was 3 years old, he was already studying and reading the classics. Daniel Webster, when he was 6 years old, in a public school memorization contest, memorized scores of Bible verses in one day at public school. And so this is typical, and I guess the final proof of that is this little book right here. This is the first textbook ever printed in America. It's called the New England Primer, and for 240 years, students learn to read out of this book. This is when they're at words of 3 syllables, and here's your memory work. The letter A. A. A wise son makes a glad father, but a foolish son is the heaviness of his mother. That's a Bible verse. B. Better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and trouble therewith. That's a Bible verse. C. Come unto Christ, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, he will give you rest. That's a Bible verse. This is where we learn to read. So how early is too early? Well, just start your kids.
From the beginning.
They have no basis to say, Mom, you can't teach me that. I'm too young for that. It's the expectations we put on them. And so you see from American history what we do here. And this little book right here, a fun little book done by President John Quincy Adams, he did this book, and it shows 10-year-old Americans how to read the Bible from cover to cover once every year. So 10-year-old Americans. So a book from a president, how to read the Bible cover to cover. So that's our history and that's our heritage. We were into the Bible, the founding fathers into the Bible. Let me go to a guy named Fisher Ames. Now, most folks today have never heard of Fisher Ames. Fisher Ames is a framer of the Bill of Rights. He's the guy credited with coming up with the House language for the First Amendment of the Constitution. Now,
this is where we have our freedom of religion.
That's freedom of religion, yeah. Freedom of conscience, freedom of press and speech, and all the others. Interesting thing about this framer of the First Amendment is he's looking at schools in his day, and he's noticing that in the schools they're putting in lots of new textbooks, and he's kind of wondering about that, and he says, I read them, and it's in a piece here. It's an op-ed piece that ran in a national magazine called The Palladium, and he says, I've looked at the books, and they have good content. The moral content is really good. He said, but here's what I'm noticing. The more textbooks we're putting in the classroom, the more time we're having to spend on those textbooks. He says, the more time we spend on the textbooks, the less time we have available to spend on the Bible. He said, if we're not careful, the Bible is going to start drifting to the back of our classrooms, and this can't be tolerated in American education. So there's the guy who gave us the First Amendment, the House version of the First Amendment, and he's saying, don't ever let the Bible drift to the back of classrooms. See, that's how he was educated.
And he had seen the results of a generation raised with that being the main textbook.
I mean, that's the way we've done it in America. The very first public school law we have in America is 1647. It was passed to make sure the students knew the Bible, because then you could understand how government's supposed to operate. You'd understand how the courts are supposed to operate. You'd make sure civil atrocities didn't get introduced like they had in Europe. So knowing the Bible is really key. You got folks here like Benjamin Rush, the signer of the Declaration. John Adams said he's one of the three most notable signers. Benjamin Rush is called the father of public schools under the Constitution. So you'd think, hey, that's a pretty important guy. Not today. We don't talk about him. And it could be because right here in this piece, he goes through in 1790 and 91 and gives a dozen reasons we'll never take the Bible out of public schools in America. A dozen reasons the Bible will always be our number one textbook. And in explaining it, he gave a great warning to future generations. He said, any generation that takes the Bible out of schools is going to spend all of its time and money fighting crime. Because you could prevent crime right there in the classroom, but teaching the Bible, you take it out, you're going to spend all your time money fighting.
So sounds like a prophecy coming true.
Oh, yeah,
today,
exactly.
Right?
And see, what happened was in 1963, in two cases, Abney and Shemp Murray Collette, the U.S. Supreme Court announced out of the clear blue, time to take the Bible out of schools. Yeah, we've been doing it for 300 years. Time to go. And the court said there's no historical precedent or legal precedent for what they did. And so they take it out. Going back to Benjamin Rush, he had a great quote, and he said, the Bible, when not read in schools, is seldom read in any subsequent period of life. Now, we've gone through.
That's what's happened.
That's it. Yeah. So go back to answer your question. You take a founding father like Benjamin Franklin. Out of the 250, everybody will know him, but he's one of the least religious. And I do use the term least because that's a comparative term. So I want to give you a line from Franklin, a speech from Franklin, part of a speech that he gave at the Constitutional Convention. And it's a really significant speech for him because Franklin is the first guy in American history to say, let's have a United States of America. Way back in 1754, the Albany Plan of Union, he said, let's not be 13 colonies, let's be united. Didn't happen back then. But 22 years later, he's one of the 56 guys who signs the Declaration. Now we're going to step closer.
He was the one that cast the vision for what we could become.
For two decades, he's been saying, guys, this is me. So now he gets to sign the document that helps kind of birth that. 7 years later, he's one of only three guys who signs the peace treaty to end that. Now we're getting really close. And 4 years later, he's sitting at the Constitutional Convention where we're reforming the United States of America. He's loving this, at least initially. 5 weeks in, he's not loving it anymore, because 5 weeks in, the convention's falling apart. All the delegations came with their own agendas. You had the New York plan, you had the New Jersey plan, and the Connecticut plan, and the Virginia plan, and guess what? New York didn't want the Virginia plan, they wanted the New York plan.
So nobody's agreeing.
Nobody's agreeing. And Franklin's watching this fall apart. He's been wanting this for 33 years, and he's now watching it fall apart. He's the old man of the convention, 81 years old, by far the elder statesman. Listen to what he says.
In this situation of this assembly, groping as it were in the dark to find political truth, and scarce able to distinguish it when presented to us, how has it happened, sir, that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of Lights to illuminate our understandings? In the beginning of the contest with Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayers in this room for the divine protection. Our prayers, sir, were heard, and they were graciously answered. All of us who were engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of a superintending providence in our favor. And have we now forgotten that powerful friend? Or do we imagine we no longer need his assistance? I have lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men, and if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings, that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. And we ourselves shall become a reproach and a byword down to future ages.
Now, he's one of our five least religious founding fathers. And what you just heard there was nine sentences. Here's the question. The nine sentences just heard, how many Bible verses did he quote?
So this is a guy that was raised in this kind of education where he was taught the Bible, so it's going to come out in what he says, but I recognize two or three.
No, 13 verses.
13 Bible verses in nine sentences.
Franklin quoted 13 Bible verses in nine sentences. So here you have your least religious founding father who knows the Bible that well because that's how they were raised in that generation. Now, let's shift to a founding father that no one's going to question his faith, and that's Patrick Henry.
Yeah.
Patrick Henry, very outspoken. We're going to go to March the 23rd, 1775. We are at St. John's Church in Richmond. The reason we're at church is because that's where the legislature met.
So this is not a church service.
It's not a church service. The legislature is meeting there, and they've had what's called the gunpowder affair, which the governor's come in and taken the gunpowder away from all the Virginians. And by the British Bill of Rights, you can't do that. They have the right to keep and bear arms. They have the right to defend themselves. Now the governor's come in, broken the British Bill of Rights because we hadn't separated from Great Britain yet. And the question is, what are we going to do? Well, Patrick Henry knew what to do. He went and got 4,000 Virginia farmers. He got them all together. He climbed up on top of rock. He preached him a sermon out of Exodus 20, and then those 4,000 farmers went and attacked the 200 British soldiers, got all their gunpowder back.
Wow.
But now we've got a conflict because the government has come after us, violating our rights, and so what are we going to do? So the argument is going that, we really need to stay with the government because they've got the greatest military in the world. We're just a bunch of farmers. There's nothing we can do about this. We just need to do whatever they say. And Patrick Henry says, no, that we need to do what's right. We have laws. We should follow the law. Here's what Patrick Henry said.
Sir, we are not weak if we make a proper use of those means which the God of nature has placed in our power. 3 millions of people armed in the holy cause of liberty, and in such a country as that which we possess, are invincible by any force which our enemy can send against us. Besides, sir, we shall not fight our battles alone. There is a just God who presides over the destinies of nations, and who will raise up friends to fight our battles for us. The battle, sir, is not to the strong alone. It is to the vigilant, the active, the brave. Gentlemen may cry, peace, peace, but there is no peace. The war is actually begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Our brethren are already in the field. Why stand we here idle? What is it that gentlemen wish? What would they have? Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God! I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death!
Now, he made a very compelling argument, but I think today most folks would miss his argument because, again, in what he just did, that was 14 sentences. Same question. How many Bible verses did we just hear in 14 sentences?
I probably recognize less out of that one.
Yeah.
Than Franklin, so I'm not even sure I could recognize any of them.
11 Bible verses.
11 in 14 11. Verses.
So 14 sentences. You have him here with 11 Bible verses in 14 sentences.
Talking about war and battle,
war.
Something that we don't typically...
And he quoted Bible phrase after Bible phrase after Bible... But see, they didn't need to say back then, now I'm quoting to you out of Job 4:12. They knew it. They recognized it. Now today, we need somebody to tell us you're quoting the Bible because we don't recognize the Bible
And
anymore.
Nobody there in the legislature stood up and said, we don't like you speaking the Bible at us like that.
Oh, no. They stood up and said, hey, we think you're nuts. Yeah. We are too weak. And, you know, that was the conflict they had. Are we weak enough or strong enough? One more founding father. Here's a founding father that today we're often told he's a deist founding father. George Washington. George Washington is going to visit the various colonies. He's going around to visit these colonies, and he's on his way to Rhode Island. And in Rhode Island, Newport, there is a Hebrew congregation in Newport, and they so appreciate everything he did for their civil and religious liberties. And so they wrote him a glowing letter of how we just think God's raised you up and you're such a wonderful leader and we thank God for you. And so George Washington responds back with a letter to the Hebrew congregation at Newport. Look at what George Washington told that congregation.
May the children of the stock of Abraham who dwell in this land continue to merit and enjoy the goodwill of the other inhabitants, while everyone shall sit in safety under his own vine and fig tree, and there shall be none to make him afraid. May the Father of all mercies gather light and not darkness in our paths and make us all in our own several vocations useful here, and in his own due time and way everlastingly happy.
Now that's only two sentences. Same question.
And this is the supposed deus.
How many Bible verses? Two sentences.
No idea. Two in two sentences.
Nine Bible verses.
Nine Bible verses in two sentences.
And they recognized them because most of them were out of the Old Testament. Mm. So that Hebrew congregation, hey, we know all the... There's a couple of New Testament verses he used as well.
He didn't have to reference them. He didn't have to explain them.
People knew them.
Yeah.
See, today we've become biblically illiterate. There's a great quote by John Quincy Adams. He said, with regard to the history contained in the Bible, it's not so much praiseworthy to be aware of it as it is shameful to be ignorant of it. And we've come to the point where that we don't know it.
Why is that, though? Why is it shameful to be ignorant? Why is this so important? I mean, we said it had a big impact on that generation, but what's the difference if we don't have it today?
Here's the difference. Let me take this book right here. This book, Godless Constitution. When somebody today says you have a godless constitution, what they have just told me is that they are biblically illiterate. They wouldn't recognize a Bible verse if it bit them on the ankle.
So we're back to not recognizing the idioms, not recognizing even in the Constitution.
That's right. Even
references.
In the Constitution, Bible verse after Bible verse included in the Constitution.
Mm, yeah.
And what brung us to that point of success as a nation was the Bible undergirded, even with Franklin. The Bible undergirded his thinking and what he said and how he communicated, and they understood those principles because it's not just religious stuff. This is true, tried, and tested principles that work. And if you use these things, and by the way, we used them and it did work.
And we saw the results.
And we
had so many years and so many generations of the greatest nation in history.
And by the way, if you want to know where they're getting their material, you go to the back of the book and check footnotes. And it's not just footnotes. You also want to check sources. If you're looking in the 1760s, you don't want to be quoting books from the 1960s. You want to be quoting books from the 1760s.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of revision that happens over history. Go back to the original eyewitness documents. So go to the back of the book, go to footnotes, and as we start looking for footnotes, there are no footnote numbers here. It's a very short section, just a few pages. And then we see this. Quote, we have dispensed with the usual scholarly apparatus of footnotes.
So wait, they're going to completely change history and what happened in the founding of America and then not give any evidence.
Not a single footnote. But I've seen court cases where the court says, oh no, you can't have religious activities in public because we have a godless country. And they cite this book as the proof. Hey, how about going back and citing the founding fathers? But let's take their speeches and just put the Bible verses in that you don't recognize anymore. And then,
or as you said earlier, the father of the public schools.
That's right.
Saying
that's
that
right.
We should have the Bible.
Or even Fisher Ames, who did the First Amendment.
Yeah.
Why don't we quote him in the courts when he says, don't let the Bible get that back of school? Now, we don't have it in schools today, no worries. You just start reading the Bible for yourself, wherever you are. You get into it right now and start knowing that Bible.
And it's no wonder then that our foundations are falling apart. It's no wonder we're losing freedom. Yeah. It's no wonder we've forgotten what the foundations are. If we don't have this in the classroom, as you said, so that they'll read it later in life, then we've got to do something different. If we have a situation now where our public schools no longer do what the father of public schools said to do, if we want to restore the foundations of freedom, then we've got to come back to the biblical foundations. You're saying we personally need to read it. What else can we do for the culture to get the Bible back in and recognize so that we can have those strong foundations of freedom?
Go back to John Quincy Adams right here. This little book he did for 10-year-olds. He pointed out to 10-year-olds, he said, I read through the Bible once every year. Now, that was very common for the founding fathers. As a matter of fact, one of our founding fathers we rarely talk about today is a guy named Roger Sherman. Roger Sherman is the only founding father to sign all four founding documents. He's the guy credited with giving us the bicameral system whereby we have a House and a Senate. He came up with a wonderful innovation of the Electoral College whereby states and the people get a voice in choosing the president. It's a great system.
Instrumental then in the foundation.
Instrumental. He's a key founder and nobody knows him today. Now, I have here a newspaper from Washington, D.C. This goes back old. And by the way, Roger Sherman also helped frame the Bill of Rights. So he's in the early Congress. He spent several years in Congress. And this is an early newspaper from back in the 1830s. And it talks about Roger Sherman in Congress. And I'm just going to turn to the bottom here, this little note they've got about Roger Sherman in Congress, and look what it says, Roger Sherman. It says, the volume which he consulted more than any other was the Bible. It was his custom at the commencement of every session of Congress to purchase a copy of the scriptures, to peruse it daily, and to present it to one of his children on his return. Now, here you've got a famous congressman, and his habit is, every time he goes to Congress, he takes a new Bible with him. And as he's studying the Bible and reading through it every day, he makes the annotations in the margin, what the Lord's showing him. Now, by the way, he had 15 kids. I mean, you got to read the Bible a lot to get a Bible to all your kids.
Yeah, you got a lot of Bibles to pass out.
But these guys read the Bible once every year. That was what they did. Now, we need to do that today.
Yeah.
There's easy ways to do it. Here's a way anybody can do it. The one-year Bible. Go to any bookstore, get a copy of the one-year Bible. And if you want to be lazy, like some of us do.
It's right there on the app,
we
right?
We got an app with it, and you can just hit the app, and it'll read it to you. So while you're brushing your teeth and getting ready in the mornings, it'll read the daily. All you have to do is read 3 chapters a day of the Bible, and you'll cover the entire Bible in a year. That's easy. That's
so are you saying
minutes.
To folks out there that might be watching that want to restore foundations, that have started studying the founding fathers, the founding documents, it's just as important to study that founding document, the Bible, as it is
to study the Constitution? You want to understand their speeches if you don't understand where they got their ideas.
Yeah.
And you know, we're told by Jesus in Matthew 12:34, that out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks.
Okay.
Second thing
so
to
read,
do.
Read the Bible. At home, this is a
make
family
a commitment
thing.
Once
individually, read through the Bible once
read
a year.
The Bible
that's
once
following
year.
In the footsteps of the founding fathers.
And if you want to see how the Bible applies, the Founders Bible. That's what the Founders Bible does.
Yeah.
It takes all these Bible verses the founders used and shows you where they took Bible verses and applied it in government. So read the one-year Bible. Get through it once a year. If you want to see how it applies, read the Founders Bible. Second thing you do, start memorizing scriptures. Easy thing to do. Memorize as a starting place Psalms 119 verses 10 and 11. That ends up by saying, thy word have I hid in my heart that I might not sin against you. Start by hiding his word in your heart. Real simple thing to do.
And I'm assuming that the founding fathers did that because these speeches you shared with us, they were getting up off the cuff
out of their heart.
And
that's
they were
right.
giving those speeches and quoting verse after verse after
just
verse.
Just spontaneously giving a speech. You know, whatever they saw happening, they addressed Patrick Henry's in the debate, and he's in the heat of the debate. Guess what came out of his mouth?
Yeah.
And see, that's the third thing. Start speaking the word. But you can't speak the word if it's not inside. So you start by reading the word, then start memorizing the word, then it'll start coming out and speaking the word. And that's one of the things we can do to restore the foundations of freedom in America.
TBN is bringing changes to serve you better. The Blessed Life program is now airing daily at 9:30 a.m. Pacific. Watch daily preaching of the best-selling author and a senior pastor of the Gateway Church, Robert Morris, on deep and educational concepts of biblical truth applicable to everyday life. Be inspired by the word of wisdom. TBN also continues to expand and develop innovative programs. Recently added to their lineup are Open Your Bible with Mark Rutland.
The Word says, great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised.
Life in the City with Pastor Alberto and Ashley Bellow.
As pastors of The Gathering Los Angeles, a Hollywood church plant, we see firsthand some of the difficulties that come with being a follower of Christ in such a big city.
And coming soon, a new show from Christian life coach Ron Kardashian. Be sure to watch these and other programs and log on to TBN Salsa for more information. Thank you, partners. Your support makes this all possible. Coming up next, Ever Increasing Faith, hosted by Dr. Frederick Price.